And we are burning down the house. Yes, here every Wednesday at 8 p.m. on heritageradionetwork.com. A continuing conversation about the culture of architecture and design, in which we tear down, lay forth, and build up the elements, the attitudes, opinions, obsessions, fantasies, biases, passions, and ideas that inform and direct the creation of our built environment. I am Curtis B. Wayne, your host, and our sponsor this evening is Hearst Ranch. Grass-fed, grass-finished beef. Now, you wouldn't think that that would make a big difference, but what you get and you go to the local grocery store is corn-fed, corn-finished, and it's full of corn sugar, and you're just really consuming corn. And you have Hearst Ranch beef, you're getting the real experience. Farmed since 1865, it's the Hearst family, the publishing company family, and it is fabulous beef. And you can learn more about it at hearstranch.com. This evening in studios, our guests are students from the Cooper Union for the Advancement of Science and Art here in New York City at Cooper Square, 7th Street and 3rd Avenue. I'd like you all to introduce yourselves. Come around the microphones. Come close. Starting over here, counterclockwise. So, speak.
Andre Spellbrink. I'm pre-K, I say.
Pre-K.
I'm not a student.
You're a participant in this class.
I am, yeah.
These are all students in Professor Rod Knox's class, Architecture and Eloquence. For the last 2 weeks, Roderick and I have been speaking our opinions about architecture and eloquence, and this is the apotheosis of the experiment in new media pedagogy, which has been wildly successful and widely practiced at Harvard College. You can look at the companion blog, and I'll give you a link, and you can learn all about what they're doing up there in Cambridge. But here in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on a Wednesday evening in November, we're going to talk about architecture and eloquence. Next student.
And my name is Andres Loire, and I'm a third year at Cooper.
Thank you.
My name is Rolando Vega, and I'm also a third year at Cooper.
I'm Catherine Bajo. I'm third year at Cooper.
I'm Danny Wills, and I'm also a third year at Cooper.
Angelique Pierre, I'm a fifth year at Cooper.
My name is Jesus Yepes, and I'm a fourth year.
Very good. And we also have Roderick L. Knox, professor of architecture. Yeah. Now, we're going to start off with a controversial building in Manhattan, designed by Frank Gehry, the Beekman Towers, a base structure that includes a school and then a silvery tower above us. Tell us about that, Andres.
This is all about, of course, eloquence and seeing, you know, what is in a building and what is nice. I would like to start to say what I don't like.
Nice.
And what is not.
Nice. It could be eloquent and rude as hell.
Okay.
But okay, go ahead. Nice. Nice. Do we want nice or do we want eloquent?
No, eloquent.
Okay, thank you.
We'll do eloquent.
Okay, go forward. I know that you're pre-K and you're not used to feisty repartee.
No, okay. Absolutely not.
What is your background? Gehry. What is your background?
I'm originally, first of all, from Holland.
Yes.
And most people pronounce the city Utrecht wrong because it's Utrecht. So, you know, if you make a reference to the Schroeder house, maybe you might want to remember that,
you know,
how to pronounce it.
I guarantee that I'll get it wrong every time, but go ahead.
Utrecht,
okay.
And I came here. What was your question? What was I? What
do
my
you
background?
Like about Gehry's Beekman Towers, and why is it eloquent?
Right. And to say that is that I really do not like Gehry. He All the buildings he made.
But he speaks so well of you.
I understand. It is something I really cannot relate to. And I always have, whenever I saw a picture or the building itself, it was something like, how can you do this? This is not eloquent at all. Now.
And yet.
I was biking through Manhattan last Sunday. And suddenly I see this building in the middle of Wall Street area with all the Wall Street buildings and the old governmental buildings, the City Hall, etc. And suddenly I see this building standing there. I think it's on Beekman and Nassau.
Nassau. I can't speak Utrecht, but you can speak Nassau.
But Nassau is actually a Dutch name. But let's get over this thing, please.
We appropriated that in 1638.
Yes, you stole it.
It's Nassau. Thank you. Nassau. Okay.
Okay.
That's great.
So suddenly you see that building. And I think it's an orange pedestal.
Are you here from the Dutch government to reappropriate New Amsterdam?
No, we already did that. 400 years ago, actually. So you see a big pedestal. It's an orange pedestal. And then when you look up, you see a building wrapped up in metal. I don't know if it's titanium or because that's what I think he likes to use.
Yeah. It's titanium.
It's titanium.
Or titanium in Dutch. Titanium,
And as I was looking at it, I was really thinking, wow, is this a Gehry building? Is that really true? So I took out my BlackBerry and looked up if he ever did a building except that other stupid building on the west side, the glass building. And yes, there was a building. This was Gehry. And I was really impressed by it for a couple of things. And if you talk about eloquent, it is a building that stands out, that speaks out between all the other buildings. And somebody will make the famous remark that all the detail, when you are limited in what you can do, and actually we talked about it this morning in class, when you're limited in what you can do, maybe you can come to beautiful things. And when you look at this building, well, I looked at that building, I was really impressed by how a steel core is being skinned, put a skin on, but you have a very well-looking building in the middle of Manhattan.
But it's not just a skin in our conventional sense of curtain wall. It's a shimmering and flowing sculptural effect.
Absolutely.
Every floor has a different profile.
Yeah, it's just...
Did you want to say that? No, okay. Please, this is a conversation. This is not an interview. So if anyone has a comment, just grab a mic and just speak up. You don't have to be afraid. It's radio. We can edit these things out. Go ahead.
So...
But what do you find eloquent about the juxtaposition between the orange podium and or plinth and the shimmering titanium skin above?
The podium I do not understand. I was thinking, and I have to look it up or see if there was some background on it.
But it has a different use, so I think there's going to be a school in there.
Ah, okay. Doesn't matter so much. But if you look into that building, and it is a residential building. It's I think it's 70 stories high. I think it's 300 to 1,200 square foot apartments in it. So pretty small, actually. And I'm sure they are rentals. First, it was an idea to do it co-op, and I think the whole real estate market brought that down.
It was going to be a condo.
Condo.
And that market is dead.
Right.
Dead,
so right now it's a rental. Yeah. I have no idea what that ever is going to cost. It must cost really a fortune. But it is. Why is it eloquent? Is that just by giving it a twist, the building a twist, and making a cut in the building and the clad of titanium over it, gives you different corners in the house as I envision it. I mean, it's not finished, you can look at it at different points. You can look through different windows and have a view of the Hudson and Lower Manhattan. I think that, although not finished, I think it's eloquent. It's something that is more eloquent than he ever did.
Really? Oh, well, it's certainly the tallest building, I think, that he's designed. And
that has nothing to do with eloquency.
Oh, you know, it depends on whether you have an edifice complex or something. I'm much attracted to the voluptuous geometries of that skin, and I don't mind that it attempts to stand apart from all of its neighbors, because they're all deeply rooted in a different time. Many of those neighboring buildings are Art Deco buildings that we've spoken about in previous programs, and I think it's all right. The other Gehry building in New York, the one at 9th Avenue and 10th Avenue and 19th Street, needs to be on a plinth, but it's not. And so I think in this regard, it's a better building for setting off that voluptuous shape.
But because the site was so limited, it made him better, is your point.
Yeah. Just and what you just said, all the other buildings are so rigid.
Professor,
if
you're
going
to speak, it would be good if you were closer to a microphone, because
although
you have a very good projective voice, it's...
I'm sure they'll hear it, because they can hear laughter outside.
Well, okay.
All those...
Well, feel free to come closer in the future. Far be it from me to tell you what to do. Ever. Let's have a little bit of voluptuary music as we move into the next topic of construction. Here we are, burning down the house, tearing down, and laying forth back up new understandings about the built environment. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host. This program is brought to you by Hearst Ranch, hearstranch.com, for more information. And we have students from the Cooper Union for the Advancement of Science and Art, my alma mater. Next. Also, this is engineered by Nat Wiener and produced by Jack Inslee. Props to you guys. Thank you for an excellent job always. So, we had a little bit of voluptuary music from the opera Lacme, two mezzo-sopranos, and it put us in a new sensibility. We're going to talk about Native American aesthetic sensibilities. Giggling's a good. That's good. Speak to us. Now, just speak just straight to the mic. Don't look at me. Look at the mic.
All right.
Who are you?
You can look at me.
Okay. I'm Catherine Bajo, and I'm third-year architecture. at Cooper Union.
Are you, or are you asking me?
Super nervous. Okay.
Show me your identification, Catherine. Tell us about what you've learned and what you want to share.
I'm from Denver, Colorado, originally, and I think, well, when I moved to New York, it was really hard because there's a vastness of man-made grid, and...
Speak to the mic.
I guess there's this sense of spirituality that was lost from coming from the West to the East Coast, and...
You missed all of the smog in Denver?
No. Just the deserts and the high plains and the mountains and actually the thin air and the brisk air, not the pollution. But I guess what I wanted to talk about was how... One can find eloquence in the Anasazi Pueblos. I guess.
Now, the Anasazi were native peoples who lived in New Mexico and Arizona.
The Four Corners, yeah.
What are the Four Corners?
Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, and Arizona.
Yeah. So near and around the Grand Canyon.
Right, the Southwest. So I guess the eloquence that you find in the Pueblos are based on the rhythmic patterns of the native people. So they live their lives based on the rhythms of the day. So their day starts with the sun rising, and their day ends with the sun setting.
Now, I'm not really conversant with the term pueblo. I think in Spanish it just means the house of the people, right?
Yeah, it's a community.
Right. Are you talking about current day pueblos, or say the cliff dwellers? Ruins that we see at Montezuma's
Mesa Park. Verde and Pueblo Bonita.
Right.
Those are commonly known pueblos in the Southwest.
So you're talking mostly about the ones that have been abandoned and rediscovered by white folks.
I think they are truly American ruins.
Sure. Well, they are, of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, go on. What do you find eloquent about them?
The native peoples took the material of the earth and created their own designs on the earth to reflect not only their culture, but also the material that they used to build the buildings, and also a hierarchy in their lifestyle.
Which was?
Well,
were they hunter-gatherers, or did they have agriculture?
Both. Actually, Mesa Verde was a totally sustainable community because, obviously, because they were native peoples, and they also did agriculture, and there is a thesis that their community vanished because they wiped the resources clean. Is that the good?
Well, no, that's fine. But what other native, other tribes, or the plains people, for example, moved from place to place, and they had portable shelter.
Right.
They didn't stay in any one place for very long. So
nomadic.
Thank you. And are you sure that these communities didn't cease to exist because there were prolonged periods of drought, for example?
Maybe, but also because they... So the Anasazis... Okay, so I'm talking about Mesa Verde, and so they were cliff dwellers, and they lived in the cliff primarily for protection from other tribes. And they farmed on top of the mesas.
Well, how did they do that? Did they have ramparts or did they just pull up their ladders?
They had ladders.
Uh-huh. And so, because this is radio, if you could describe, perhaps in modern terms, you know, what do they look like?
In modern terms?
Yeah.
As
you're standing and looking at these ruins now, what do you see?
I see...
Well, first of all, what are the walls constructed of?
The walls are the rock. They are the cliff.
So they're carved out of the living rock.
Yes. By wind, supposedly.
By wind?
Yes.
Carved by the wind.
Carved by the wind. And within these bowl-shaped dwellings... the Anasazi peoples built their own dwellings.
So they carved into the wind-scoured faces. Do they have windows? Doors?
Yeah, actually, I have this kiva on my page right now.
No, a kiva is a sweat lodge. Much like what we're experiencing now here in the shipping container. Because this is radio and you can't see, we're all down to our skivvies and Rod is fanning the flames and the perspiration is rolling off of our foreheads as we're having a spiritual...
Only thing, right? Women didn't go in there, did they?
Well, some of them were used... Most of them were used for spiritual rituals.
And women were not allowed in.
I don't know.
I think they had girls' nights.
Yeah. If you don't mind, I never find out how they got old people in down there.
Yeah.
I mean, did they like tie them up and lower them down over the side? You have to be athletic to get in this thing, you know.
A kiva, for those of you who are listening who aren't well educated in the arcana of Native American ways, as I'm looking at Catherine's sketch in her book, it's a round structure with an entrance vestibule that's generally orthogonal, and there would be a fire in the center.
Actually, they argue that this the entrance was on top of the fire pit.
Oh, that's lovely. You get immersed through smoke.
But it's also because of the structure, on top of the kivas was a dome, and structurally there is always a hole.
Yes.
On top of the dome.
Well, that lets the smoke out.
Well, that
otherwise, the people in there are going to end up as living hams.
Actually, there is a ventilator that... So there's a fire pit, and this is all in a linear line, but there's a sipapu, which is...
Sipapu?
Sipapu.
This is different from seppuku, which is what the Japanese do when they screw up.
which is they looked into this hole that was dug into the earth and could see the underworld. And
cool. I'd love that. And you can see the spirits down below.
Right next to it was a fire pit.
Now you spoke of living, you know, in the solar world. The sun rises and then the sun sets. Is there any specific architectural expression that you can point us to that shows us how this worked out at Mesa Verde or Montezuma's or any of the other cliff dweller structures?
Well, I guess in the kivas, the idea that life is
this
rhythmic pattern.
But in the kiva, which is a domed structure, it's always eternally night. So we have a contrast between living in the solar pattern of daytime versus the Kiva, where it is always a connection to the dark underworld. No?
Yes. But I feel like there's that rhythm of life and of day and of night and of a time of sowing and a time of harvest that the...
That is ceremonially celebrated in the Kiva by the warriors.
But also conceptually.
I think you need to write a paper about this next year and expand it.
Is it more than a rudimentary structure, though? Because, I mean, what
could you come a little closer? We're not really hearing you.
Is it more than rudimentary? Is it what... is it embellished or adorned in any way? The Kiva.
The Kiva?
Yeah.
Embellished in what?
With ornaments.
Personalized, somehow. Beyond utility or...
I mean, yeah, there's...
But probably we don't know because we can only look at modern
the
Kivas.
The ruins, but...
Yeah.
I feel like spiritually there's a sipapu... And then there are benches.
How do you spell that?
Sipapu. There's pilasters, and then just benches among the pilasters.
So what you find
architecturally, it's embellished.
So if I could summarize, what you find eloquent about their mode of building is that it is. They are totally in and of their natural environment, living an elemental life. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. It's only radio. Don't worry. Let's hear some Native American sacred music. Burning down the house here on HeritageRadioNetwork.com, where we're talking about student reactions to architecture and eloquence. Next up, also in the Americas. Yeah, you. You decide. Well, you know, let's talk about some Venezuelan stuff. All right. Get your phones on. Speak up. Reintroduce yourself, please.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jesus Yepes, and I'm a fourth year.
Cool. Now, you want to talk about a project by Juan Carlos Villanueva.
Yeah.
Who was a Venezuelan architect in the mid-20th century. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, he was very involved with CIAM, the Congress International of Modern Architecture. He certainly right. knew everybody who was in that movement. Tell us about this project.
Well, this week I got really interested in project housing and housing for the masses, especially masses with that are poor. And... Venezuela is a special case because the tendency is that right now is that houses are being built along the earth. They're called ranchos. And
you mean like a ranch house? No. An American ranch house?
No.
A rancho in Venezuela is something different?
Yeah, a rancho is a shanty house, I guess.
Oh, like a favela in Brazil.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's interesting because they take up the shape of the landscape, and Venezuela is located in a valley with the mountains as a restriction, so it cannot grow beyond.
It all flows down into the Great Lake Titicaca. Or however you pronounce that. Titicaca. I don't know. How do you pronounce that?
Titicaca. Yeah.
No offense to Hugo Chavez or anybody in Venezuela. Go ahead. Yeah. No, we're not going to talk about Hugo Chavez. We're going to talk about architecture by Villanueva or Villanueva.
Villanueva, that sounds like a... That
name is Newtown.
True, right? All right.
He was a Spaniard. You know, his family came from Spain, and he did some good architecture. Well, tell us about the architecture.
Yeah. So
and why it's eloquent.
A very famous project that he did was it's called 23 de Enero development, which are housing blocks. Similar to...
Did you just say $3?
No.
Tres dinero?
23.
No. Three 20, monies, no.
23.
Oh, 23, okay. Sorry.
January 23rd.
No hablo español. Okay. Go on, please. Right. This is a conversational show. You have to understand. This is not Charlie Rose. This is not an interview on NPR. We're just hanging out here at Roberta's restaurant and talking about
having some beer and everything.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go on.
Don't say that.
Okay. The 23 de Enero project is very special, and I think it's one of the most eloquent spaces in Venezuela. Even though it is a war zone right now, but its intent was very eloquent. There were housing blocks like Le Corbusier Unitet, l'habitation in Merced.
Mm-hmm.
And they are placed in a similar scale. So they are placed in a...
They're concrete structures.
They're concrete structures.
And they're sort of mega structures, yes?
Yeah.
In Marseille, yes?
Low income
or middle income?
Low income.
Low income.
For poor people. Get them out of the favelas, out of the shanties.
Yeah, and...
And when was this built?
I think it was 1940s. I can't remember for sure.
Well, you need to do some research here, my friend.
I just started yesterday.
Okay, well...
All right, the reason they're eloquent, and I think it's because they're placed in a zigzag manner, in a zigzag pattern. And they leave spaces. These big, huge superstructures leave empty spaces in between each other that allow for different activities to take place.
And like, do people to garden in those spaces?
They can do anything from gardening and protesting.
Well, they can, but what do they do? Do you think?
How did it work out? Right now, it has changed dramatically. You cannot go there as a tourist.
So you don't know.
It's a war zone.
Who are they fighting?
It's a criminal zone. It's
Oh,
it's tough.
Not even the police goes there right now.
You mean they have the same problem that Colombia has with narco terrorists?
I think it's beyond that.
Well, all right. So theoretically, this should have been. That's an interesting development, because a lot of well-intended low-income housing in the United States, it turned into Pruitt-Igoe, or in Chicago, and they had to They had to tear them down. They became hothouses of crime.
So they blew up.
But you find that the forms were eloquent.
Yeah,
and the form, their intention.
Yeah, the form they take in the city, and also Caracas is a. I mean, I have a friend that brags about Caracas being the most temperature. What can I say? Like 80 degrees.
Place. Temperate, always nice.
Yeah, it's always nicest place.
It's like being in Hawaii.
That's it.
Never too cold, never too hot.
Yeah, and the interesting.
Goldilocks. The Goldilocks zone.
Yeah, just right. Not too hard and not too soft. Yes.
It's just
I'll eat this porridge and I'll sleep in this bed. Thanks. Thanks, Rod.
There is anything there very.
So this is in Caracas.
Yeah, in Caracas.
And. If you could speak slowly for those of us who aren't facile in Spanish, what's the project called again?
23 de enero.
23 de enero. Okay, well, you're going to have to write that down.
What does it mean?
For Jack.
January 23rd.
What happens
and
on
what
January
is that?
23rd?
Is
it, there must be something.
Oh, I think that's the date when the Venezuelans drove out the United Fruit Company and the United States Marines. Maybe that was Honduras.
I don't know. Mexico has one, too.
Sure.
Right,
But what does the project look like? I mean, you've described it in clinical terms. Is it concrete? Is it colorful?
Yeah, it's primary colors, blue, red, and yellow, and
is it sitting in a very lush and verdant environment? Is there a lot of
It's sitting on a very empty space. The pictures of it make them seem as the only thing on the landscape. So they're the only large structures in the city. So everything was cleared
all around it, and
the interesting thing is that the ranch, I mean, if you see it, the ranches were clear up and mm-hmm. they were put in a vertical position for the, and all that empty space was left.
So
it wasn't socially elegant. I mean, eloquent, sorry.
No, I think it was socially eloquent. It just didn't work out. Speak up, students. I mean, what do you think about big projects like this that wipe out an indigenous form of building and replace it with a megastructure that now...
I forgot to say, too, that this structure, I mean, the interesting thing about the temperature is that it allows the wind patterns of Caracas... They're positioned in a way that they don't need air conditioning. So in a way they're efficient and
that's a good thing.
And the greenest
eloquence of sight can be a very good thing.
Well, who would put over indigenous?
But what do we feel about this as a group of 10 architects or architects in training about? What are you laughing about? Okay, you can take your master's in social work. All right, over there. No, seriously. What do we think about these big government projects that attempt to improve the quality of life for people who are, who deserve better, and then it doesn't turn out right? What do you think about that?
Well, in the Netherlands. Go ahead.
Go.
I think that there's a social issue there that as hard as architects may try, there are certain things
we simply can't... Introduce yourself.
Angelique Pierre.
Yes, thank you.
I think there's a social aspect of things that ultimately there's a limit. There's a wall at which point architects can no longer... we can no longer intervene. There has to be a point, obviously, where the society takes it upon themselves to choose to function or not to function in the built work. We have our limitations. It's something I'm actually running into with the thesis that I'm working on now, where you have to simply accept that, try as you may, there are certain things that you simply can't do as an architect. I think that's sort of what
Angelique, that's anathema. to the whole modernist, you know, shtick that we, through construction, are going to remake the world.
Yeah, but you can't give a gift that wasn't asked for. You know, give a gift not wanted is a terrible thing. That project can work if it was in a middle class. The same thing Kabul experienced with his various units. They were some worked and some didn't. The ones that didn't work was the low income ones, and as soon as they switched them to middle income, they worked.
Well, that sounds economically elitist.
It is, but I have to understand that you have to have ambition. You have to.
But what about the people who are genuinely poor and deserve better sanitation and a clean place to live?
It has nothing to do with poverty. It has to do with your education, I guess, or your culture, or if you don't care about your neighbor, if you don't have some sort of social
contract.
It's not going to work.
This raises questions to me about the interaction of the architect with the community in terms of planning and understanding. I notice that there tends to be a lot of rejection when the community doesn't feel as though they've been involved in the planning of new projects. It seems to become an issue. There's a lot of resistance at that point. It seems to be, once again, I think it's a social problem. I think that's the point where construction has to stop and it becomes an actual conversation and not necessarily just putting something there and expecting people to go into it and respond to it. There has to be a conversation that comes before that, and I think that may open up.
And it's even in the Gary building at MIT where the professors have gone in with their own little plywood and sheetrock and made their own little compartments because his idea, he didn't consult them with this dream scheme of interaction.
Yeah, we'll talk about that next week apropos of 41 Cooper Square, I think. But, you know, your point is well taken. And if I have any editorial sort of presence here, it's my own agenda, is that to the extent that we as architects work collaboratively with the people for whom we are attempting to accommodate how they live, how they work, the work can only be better. Now, that's my experience, and I have to say that I can prove it to you that it works better. But we don't have time to talk about that. Well, so this is a architecturally eloquent and sustainable project in Venezuela, despite how it turned out. Let's have a little bit of other South American music, a little bit of Villa-Lobos, the Brazilian composer, with some Baquianas Brasileiras. Well, I know, you know, that was sad music, because it's sad when architects attempt to do right by the community and it just gets all fucked up, man, you know? Okay, now, sticking with the theme of communal habitation, we're going to talk about Stuyvesant Town and other similar... You don't have phones and you don't have a microphone. I mean, who's speaking here? Did you do one? Oh, you did. Yeah, okay. Do you have phones?
Put your phones on.
You got to have phones. Tell us who you are and what is your intention?
My name is Andres Larari, and I'm a third-year architect. And my interest in investigating what I find is eloquent in architecture kind of came in tandem with my studio assignment, where we are investigating plots in the city that we are going to develop and try to build affordable housing on top of those plots. Uh-huh. And so when I started to think about this idea of what is elegant and thinking about my experience just living in New York thus far and having experienced different neighborhoods and different built environments within the city, I thought about the urban scale. And
where did you come from?
I come from Miami.
Ah, well, that's like Mars.
Kind of, actually.
Welcome.
And so just up the street from where I live is Stuytown, Stuyvesant Town.
Stuyvesant Town?
Yeah, built after World War II, the post-war development.
And where? And that's in Manhattan?
It's in Manhattan.
And it's, where is it? East side, west side, uptown?
It's on the east side. It's between 1st Avenue and 16th, and Avenue C, between 14th and 23rd Street.
Oh, so, it's over there next to Peter Cooper Village, which is also a similar development, yes?
But developed by the same people.
Uh-huh.
And so in this, our site, by the way, for our studio assignment is Little Italy. And so this notion of building in the urban context and redefining, what you are going to build in an existing environment came to mind when thinking about eloquence. And so in looking into Stuyvesant Town...
Wait. You're speaking very fast and you're losing me in the flurry of words.
I'm basically trying to find what is eloquent in planning on the more urban scale.
On a larger scale.
Yeah. Okay. And what...
Not house by house, no. But many blocks at a time.
Yes. And interestingly, this kind of ties back to what Jesus was talking about, because it's Stuyvesant Town is housing for the masses, and at one point it was supposed to be housing for people who... were of lower means, which is today is not the case, because now the apartments are, it costs the same as they would anywhere else. But
market rate
now. Exactly.
They were for the veteran. Yeah.
Yeah, and in designing and planning Stuyvesant Town, they were able to destroy 18 city blocks. Displace 13,000 families, destroy a number of churches and existing schools, in total 600 buildings, to redevelop that area to what we know today as Stuyvesant Town. And my argument is that in doing this, in developing this huge urban scale community, they were able to just make this monotonous brick.
So you're a big fan of Jane Jacobs.
Yes, I actually have her book right here.
Okay. Jane Jacobs was a writer and theorist of the middle 20th century who found the traditional Manhattan block to be...
Yeah, and she says, and this is something that I picked up...
Go right ahead.
Reading. Yeah. I was just
Give
like,
us a quote.
Just that the city must mingle buildings in varying ages and conditions, including a good proportion of old ones. And, instead of having completely razed 18 city blocks to redevelop that area into what we know today, which is a very unsuccessful...
Yes, but Jane never explained why one must have old and new. She just throws it out there.
I think you should...
I mean, I feel like it's...
She goes... You actually should mention Robert Moses' name when you...
Well, you can't really talk about Jane Jacobs without talking about Robert Moses, and because they were like... dogs and cats and at each other philosophically at loggerheads frequently and always, because Robert Moses was a big fan of big projects, and he's responsible for all of the big expressways that run through New York. And
Cross Bronx Expressway, and the
FDR Drive and the West Side Highway and the Cross Bronx and many of the parkways, which we now take those as a given. But when it came to the Cross Manhattan Expressway that would have ripped across Broome Street, Jane Jacobs, well, she won. And we have her to thank for the fact that we don't have an elevated highway disrupting Manhattan at a very sensitive place. But go ahead.
And so I went ahead and continued to investigate this idea of the of planning on the urban scale in relation to eloquence when starting to think about my studio assignment, which is designing this apartment building on Mulberry Street in Little Italy. And so I looked into any urban planning that went into the area of Little Italy, and it happens to be that in 1976 and the City Planning Commission of Little Italy went through some planning of that area, and they did some rezoning and redistributing of programs in that area in order to make that that part of Manhattan work more efficiently. And so Mulberry Street became a pedestrian mall, and I think just looking at both of those examples, Stuytown and today's Little Italy, is a perfect example of what works and doesn't work in terms of that urban planning. For Stuytown today is like a ghost town, or at least the commercial aspects of
it.
I
disagree. I don't think Stuytown is a ghost town at all. It's full of families. It's little kids learning to walk on the walkways.
Yeah, but look at the street level of that.
It's
a gated community. Of that, yeah. There's the commercial aspect of it, the pedestrian aspect of it doesn't really exist. It's not part of the city. It should be it's like some fake country living. Whereas you go to Little Italy and there are tourists and everyone walking
the
street.
There's nothing wrong with winding paths. It's far from Central Park.
I think there's something wrong with
my
raising
oldest child learned
18
to
blocks
walk
of
on
the
those,
city
on those curvy walkways in Stuyvesant Village.
Well, I think there's something wrong with raising 18 blocks of the existing city to build that community. I mean, could you imagine what could have been done with 18 blocks and 600 buildings that they destroyed?
So this is an anti-eloquent development that you want.
Yeah,
to
I don't think Stuyvesant Town is at all eloquent.
But have you walked
I think it's
through
a monster.
There? I mean, the landscape now is really quite nice. Yes, it is.
I think you can walk through the West Village and understand what should be a model for eloquent urban planning and
but
existing.
But now, isn't that concept more greener than the old? I mean, isn't Stuyvesant?
Yeah, it's much more green.
Yeah.
I mean, greener in that there's more green space.
It's more efficient.
There's nothing that much more efficient about demolishing 18 city blocks.
Cities are green and suburbs are not. And so it's...
Yeah, you've got density and you've got landscape. I mean, to a certain degree, it is, I believe, a successful example of the tower in the park.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're short towers, so the shadows that they cast are not overly
and there's
ominous.
No space in between
they're brick boxes.
Yes, the brick boxes, but the brick is not schlock brick. The masonry is really very well done, and there is something elegant about you're not really ashamed to live there. It's not the it's not a project.
So no, it's not a project because of the landscaping, which is really quite voluptuous.
The idea is good. I know what I sympathize with what you're saying, because it's sort of like it separates itself from the city. And the reason for that is because There could have been more of them. If you go down further, and you go down and you see a lot of them, the Jacob Riesehausen and all, and as you go down Manhattan...
But they don't have the landscaping.
They don't have.
I mean, they have grass, and they don't have any trees. They don't have landscape design, whereas Stuyvesant Village and Peter Cooper Village have actual landscape that was designed by landscape architects. And that's what is required if you're going to attempt to do a project like that. Similarly to Battery Park City, which I'm surprised that no one wanted to talk about that. Yes, like Battery Park City, which is cut off from the rest of Manhattan by the West Side Highway, despite the three or four bridges that go across that highway, Stuyvesant Village is an enclave. It is not part of the grid. The streets, the avenues do not run through. I'll grant you that. So it's not the urban experience that you have everywhere else in Manhattan. But
there are not trucks passing through 3 o'clock in the morning in the middle. It's an inconvenience for those who depend on the grid and the circulation and all that. But if we're living in the city, you really do need... I used to be anti-towers in a park. But now I've switched a little bit. I think they can work. It has to do with other things. That when you have towers in the park, you really have to have the rule of law, and you have to have an agreement, a social contract that you're going to make this thing work. But I know what you're saying. I do, they're sterile because they have no shopping. They have no life. They don't. There is nothing. There's no reason to go in there unless you live there, and they can destroy a neighborhood.
Well, but no, I disagree. I mean, I lived near there, and I took my daughter to have her.
Compare that to Co-op City.
Well, Co-op, yeah. Co-op City is towers in the park, but one, the park is poorly executed, and two, the towers are too tall.
And three, no public transportation.
And there's nowhere to get there because it's out in the marshlands of the Bronx.
I guess I'm seeing it through this lens where, I mean, in specific in my studio assignment now, we are looking at the urban scale of a neighborhood, but only given one plot to work with and design something that integrates with the community. And I feel like in instances like that, in the 18 blocks that existed prior to Stuyvesant Town, numerous moments could have occurred where plots like that addressed the need to for that population and density in terms of green space in a different way, instead of completely raising those 18 blocks. And so, like, you get today in densely built areas like Little Italy, where people build apartment buildings where they then include green levels or parks beneath the buildings, and that addresses in a way the need for those things in such density, without completely obliterating the...
We only have a minute and a half to wrap this up. I don't know if we're going to have the opportunity to visit this again next week.
I just don't think Stuytown is eloquent.
I have to say that we have to honor and cherish the provenance and legacy of Jane Jacobs, and you should read all about her. This has been Burning Down the House, brought to you by Hearst Ranch, and we'll have a little bit of appropriate music in honor of Jane Jacobs. Listen.
Standing on the corner, suitcase in my hand, jacket and his corset, Jane is in her vest, and me, I'm in a rock and roll band. Huh. Riding her studs back at Jim. You know, those were different times. All the poets, they studied rules of verse, and those ladies, they rolled their eyes. some Jack, he is a banker. And Jane, she is a clerk. And both of them save their monies. And when they come home from work.